It honestly, yeah, I couldn't do it. I couldn't survive 6 months. Like, and I was so ill. I was so ill, like jaundice, yellow. And I still could not put down the bottle. And I did not recognize that as an issue at the time. Like,
so that was a few words from Paris, who's today's guest. She has a popular Australian podcast called Shit's Fucked. All things, go figure, leave it up to the Australians to just gratuitously swear in the name of a podcast. Anyway, no, she's a fantastic guest. Check out the episode, guys. I'm really glad that we got together. So today's episode is brought to you by the Ash is Awesome Apparel, specifically the You Are Loved hoodies and tank tops that are out now. Check them out, guys, at hoapodcast.com/merch. The great thing about these is you can customize the color scheme on them. It can be black or white, and with whatever highlight text and QR code color you want on them. They're really sharp. I do love that. That's what's becoming a very popular graphic, that You Are Loved graphic, and it really does help us to keep spreading the message. So check it out, guys. I do appreciate every single purchase. And here's the show.
Everybody, watchers, listeners, supporters of all kinds, welcome to another episode of the Weekend Ramble, the Ashes to Us podcast. I'm your host, Chuck LaFlange, checking in from Krabi, Thailand, halfway around the world, in Calgary, Alberta, is my lovely co-host, Dr. Lisa. How are you doing today, Lisa?
I'm getting over a cold, so bear with me if I have to mute myself from time to time. but no, I'm good. I'm doing good.
Good stuff. Good stuff. It's glad to see you. Our guest for today is Paris Le... Ah, fuck it. I lost it already. Paris, that's ADHD for you, right there, right?
It's like not less, an easy name to pronounce.
Yeah, I'm a pretty intelligent person, I like to think. So Le Maistre, we're going to say it. Okay, the way I said it, I wasn't going to say it, it's how I'm going to say it. Paris is joining us from Perth, Australia. How are you doing today, Paris, and how the hell do you pronounce your last name?
Okay. So my last name is pronounced Le Maistre. But in Australia, a lot of people just say like Le Maistre, or, you know, there's the master, which is what it means in English. So, you know, feel free to use either or. Yeah.
And, told you, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. No, I'm not going to call you master.
Damn it. I tried.
I mean, I heard, you know, something about Australians and racism, but, you know, whatever. Yeah, it opens it up with just a shot across the bow.
Shooting shots already. Yeah. God damn.
Yeah. I can't even help myself. I can't. So, you know, for a peek behind the curtain here, I guess I reached out to Paris, I don't know, probably a couple months ago now. It was quite a while ago.
Yeah, it was a while ago. Yeah. It was last year, for sure.
Yeah. And we've had some back and forth. And then, of course, she came 12 hours ago onto the, or 14 hours ago, I guess, 15 hours ago, on the Blackcast Radio with Jared from the Blacklist Podcast tonight, to do an episode of that, which was just fantastic. We had a lot of fun. And maybe get a peek of who you are and some of the things going on in your life. But I really wanted to find out more about you, Paris, so why not? What I like to do in these kind of get to know you episodes, can you remember the first time you got messed up?
The first time? all right.
Australians and their foul mouths. It's just awesome, right?
Oh, sorry.
No. No. We don't censor on the show. We don't worry too much about it.
But thank fucking God.
Profanity means something very different in Australia than it does in Canada, right? Like, it's crazy, right? So anyway, yeah.
It's how we speak. It's how we say hello. It's like
if
good morning.
If I hear five sentences in a row without a C-bomb, it's like, hey, look, these people are they're keeping it dialed down for us, right? So yeah.
First time I ever got messed up. Fuck. I reckon I would have been 13 years old. I remember stealing my dad's port of all choices. I don't know why I went for that. I think because it was sweet. I went for port and I just ended up drinking that whole bottle and I got pretty drunk. But that was probably the first time I got...
Do you remember how it made you feel?
Oh, I felt great. Yeah, this is what kind of started that slippery slope with alcohol is that... You know, I realized that I could use this as a numbing agent and that I could just feel relaxed and good and happy. And yeah, that was the start of the end.
So, and then for kind of the final in this series of questions that I use to open things up quite often here, Paris, is that with the benefit of hindsight, or were you insightful enough at the time or self-aware enough at the time is maybe a better term? To understand what it had done for you, or does that kind of understanding come with the benefit of hindsight and some lived experience?
I think like there was a degree of like I understood what it was doing for me because that's why I always went for it. Like whether or not like I was reflecting in a sense where I was like, I guess how I would now in hindsight, I think would be a bit different. But at that time, I was definitely aware that of what it was doing and what it was providing me because that's what drove me for a long time with alcohol. Like, and I was drinking daily from 13. Like it spiraled out from there. Like it was, yeah, it was pretty full on. Of
Can I ask a question, Paris?
course you can.
Like, what was kind of going on? Like, 13, you're so little, right? So, I mean, what was going on for you pre-13 that at 13, a numbing agent was attractive?
Yeah, very good question. Actually, there was a lot of stuff that was going on. I was brought up in a household that was very, very destructive. Bless my parents. I love them to bits. And look, they were doing the best that they could with the tools that they had. And I acknowledge that. They truly did do their best with what they understood. But unfortunately, there was just a lot of anger within the house. There was not, they don't, they didn't really know how to emotionally regulate. So there was a lot of huge outbursts. There was violence at times. Yeah, there was just it was just really difficult growing up in that kind of environment. Like you were constantly walking on eggshells. And for me as well, like my dad's mum, she was quite abusive towards me in the sense that it was very emotionally abusive. Like she used to lock me away in rooms from like 3 years old and isolate me from my siblings because she hated me. She just absolutely hated me because I looked like my mum and she hated my mum. So she was constantly isolating me and I would be in rooms for hours, like staring out the window, contemplating my own existence at such a young age and I'm questioning my worth. And so, yeah, that just kind of started a whole roller coaster of, mixed emotions. I didn't know who I was, why I wasn't good enough, and that was reaffirming at home and in that environment. And I just was not happy from a really, really young age. And yeah, so going through those turbulent emotions and finding something that could bring me a sense of peace for a moment, yeah, I was all over it.
And were you a sensitive kid? Like, were
Oh
you a
yeah.
kid who, felt a lot of emotions, sensitive to what was going on around you?
Absolutely. Like I was so sensitive. Like I used to cry, get worked up. I'd give myself panic attacks. I'd throw up like over anything. Like I'd always be really conscious of not wanting to hurt other people's feelings. And my mum used to say, when I was like 3 or 4 years old, I used to always come to her late at night and be like, "Mom, I just want to be happy." And she was like, at the time I thought it was cute. She was like, but now kind of reflecting back, it was really odd that you were coming to me so young and thinking about your level of happiness. Like that's actually was a giant red flag on where you were at that point in time. So yeah.
Because I definitely noticed that, like, with patients that I work with who, like, any kid's going to struggle with a chaotic home environment, right? Like, kids want stability, they want certainty, they want predictability, they want safety. And so, when you're growing up in a household where there's violence and chaos and high expressed emotions, that's difficult for any kid. But I find that people who go on to often then struggle with either anxiety or depression or addiction. There is often, when you talk about a kid's temperament, right? Because you're not born with a personality, but you are born with a temperament. And so when you go back to remembering, what were you like as a very young child? And were you somebody who was very sensitive to other people's emotions? Did you feel your own emotions really big? Like that really sensitive temperament, they struggle even more in chaotic home environments.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely was that kid for sure. Very, very sensitive to those big feelings. And I got to a point where, I was just constantly in, I guess, flight mode after a while. And I was constantly just trying to get out of people's way and at home because I just did not want to be caught up in it. It was all too much for me. It was just, yeah, it was just full on.
And did you have a safe person at home? Like, was there somebody that you felt?
There was like mom was probably my safe person. But she was also really struggling. My mom actually had cancer. So she, was sick for, a number of years when I think I was like 5 or 6, and it was really hard to, I don't know, get her kind of support for a while because she wasn't really available for us. Like, she was so unwell. And when she did recover, like, you know, she was in such a turbulent marriage as well. Like, she's just trying to do the best she can. She's got 3 kids. She's running around. She's doing all of this pretty much on her own. Like, my dad is a truck driver, so he was away a lot of the time. So yeah, it was, she only had so much time, but she did her best. Like, if I came to her crying, like, you know, she would absolutely comfort me. But it, yeah, it was all dependent on where she was at and what she could provide.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that just as like a blanket statement, I think everybody does the best they can, you know?
Yes.
I think people are always doing the best they can with what they know and what they, you know, the tools that they've got, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I know my mom, bless her, to this day, like, she's feeling a lot of guilt for not doing better back then, but I have to always reassure her. It's like, again, you were doing the best that you could under the circumstances. Like, you had a lot mm-hmm. of shit going on, like, and you didn't have really the most supportive husband either, so you were doing a lot of shit on your own. So, you know, mm-hmm. kudos to you, Ma. Like, you did amazing.
Yeah. And was there addiction in your family?
Yes, it does run in my family. My dad was a big drinker. But I wouldn't say when I was a kid that he was really like an alcoholic at any of any sense. Like, he was when he was younger, and I was a child, and my mum didn't really drink. She's a Jehovah's Witness, so she wasn't really doing that, but she used to party really hard, things like that. So she definitely had those tendencies. And then I've got uncles that suffer with alcohol addiction. And then I have siblings as well that struggle with drug addiction as well. So it definitely, definitely runs in the family.
Yeah. Yeah. So sorry, I like derailed your story. But so you were saying that when you were 13, that was like you drank a bottle of port, felt really good. And then pretty quickly you started drinking almost daily.
Oh, every day. Every day. I was stealing mom and dad's alcohol collection. I was just constantly taking bits and pieces from them everywhere that I could. And because they weren't drinking often then, they didn't really notice for a while. It actually wasn't until I was 19 that I even confessed to them that most of their alcohol collection was water and food dye.
It didn't even cross my mind. I just figured the bottles got emptied and discarded. But you're like, no. Filled them back up. Food coloring.
Food addict. No, we're much more dangerous than that. Yes, yes. That's how we know. Okay, so there now we've established all the credibility we need to, right? So, okay. The aforementioned credibility, right? So, Jesus, eh? So, then at what point does it dawn on you that you've got a problem?
It took me a really long time to acknowledge that, because even when I was 16, I ended up getting really sick and I started having some liver issues. And even then they were like, you cannot touch alcohol for like minimum 6 months. Like, your liver is cooked. Like, you cannot physically. No, I actually got it from glandular fever, but I think because I was drinking as well through that, it definitely impacted my liver as well. So I was very jaundiced and things like that through that time. And it hit me really hard, I think, because of the way that I was drinking. And it honestly, I couldn't do it. I couldn't survive 6 months. Like, and I was so ill. I was so ill, like jaundiced, yellow. And I still could not put down the bottle. And I did not recognize that as an issue at the time. Like, I can look at it back at it now and say, yeah, fuck, that was probably the beginning of the end. But no, it wasn't until with alcohol, I didn't realize that was such a bad problem till about a year ago. And I'm 31 now. So it's taken a long time for me to acknowledge that this has been a really big monster for me. Because my meth addiction, I kind of became more focused on that, which took grip of me in, when I was 20. So I was like, ah, that's the real monster. You know, this is the real problem. I need to focus on sorting that out. You know, alcohol isn't the issue, but obviously it was.
And how did you go from alcohol to meth?
So I actually was introduced to meth, firstly, when I was 14. I was telling Chuck about this earlier. I was over at a mate's house. She also grew up in an environment that wasn't the best, considering we were 14 and there was crack pipes around. And she had given it to me and said, you know, oh, it's like weed. Like, and I'd recently just started like smoking weed here and there. And I was like, oh yeah, like weed, you just smoke it, like easy. I've done that, like, you know, cruisy. And then I had it and oh my goodness, my poor little 14-year-old body was just in agony from the high that I was experiencing. It was like my heart was just absolutely beating out of my chest and I didn't sleep for 2 days. And I probably like smoked it once. Like, it was full on how my poor little body reacted. After that, I was like, oh my goodness, like, I don't know what the hell that was, but I'm never touching that again. Like, that was horrible. However, when I was 20, I actually went through a really, really traumatic experience. And I was telling Chuck earlier, it was like the stars aligned. I honestly look back on that day and I think, how the hell was I ever not going to go down that path? Like, I feel like I was destined actually to walk that path under the circumstances. Like, everything just aligned. It was beautifully set up. Like, I went through this really traumatic incident. I happened to reconnect with this chick that I used to play field hockey with when I was 13. I had no idea she was a meth addict. No fucking clue. And, you know, she was there with me that day that this incident happened. And she literally turned around being like, I've got something that will take this all away. And I'm like melting. I'm absolutely losing function. I cannot cope with these huge feelings. And it was like on a silver platter for me. And I was like, yep, done. Like, anything to stop me from feeling this way. So from 20, that kind of went on till a year ago. So it was a good 10 years of dealing with a meth addiction as well.
And rather than get you to wits, what are some of the big
D's out there in yonder? And I don't know, it's so rough. Like, it's honestly one of the hardest things I've ever been through, and I wouldn't wish it upon anyone else. But I think that, like, are you wanting like horror stories?
I don't know. I've never asked that question before, and I'm not even sure that I like the question, to be honest with you, right?
Things I'm curious about is like, what did it cost you? Like, where did that take you in life? I mean, were you sleeping under a bridge? Were you somehow managing to stay housed and working, or like, what was going on in your life?
Yeah, so I would say I was pretty functioning, like a pretty functioning addict, but you know, I was absolutely losing my mind at the same time. Like, I wouldn't say I would look at myself and be like, oh yeah, she's got it all sorted. Like, I did not, but I was managing to, you know, have shelter over my head. I never experienced homelessness, thank goodness, but I did end up falling into the adult industry, and I was actually escorting for a number of years in Melbourne, and that was not good for my habits. You know, and that's, and it cost me a lot of friendships as well. Like, you know, I was just becoming really sneaky. I was lying a lot. People didn't trust what I was saying, and it was hard because I always had a good heart and I never wanted to hurt anyone. But, you know, when you're in the depths of addiction, I just automatically went into protective mode. I was like, I don't want to let people in too close because I don't want to hurt them. I know I'm not doing the best, but this is what's helping me right now. And I don't know how to get out of this just yet. So, you know, I'll fill them in once I'm better. Like, I'll let them know once I'm good, like what's going on. And it was honestly like a sense of protection. So, it did really cost me quite a bit. And I lost my mind, really. Like, I was so far from my true self that when I did finally get sober and I reconnected with who I really am, it was incredible. I don't even know how to explain it. And then finally having that sense of peace within myself, presses.
Did you ever experience psychosis?
Yes. I was telling Chuck a story earlier. There was a brief period of time where I was actually living with a heroin addict, and she was doing hot shots, which is meth and heroin mixed together. So super dangerous and lethal combo. And she was stressing me the hell out. So I was, I was justifying this, I guess, as a reason to stay awake. But, of course it was also my addiction. But I ended up staying awake for about 3 days, and we were staying in this apartment that was at least like on the fifth or sixth floor. And I remember she was talking to me at one point, and I was looking like just straight out the window, and I'm looking at these skyscrapers like in front of me. And all of a sudden I'm seeing like this SWAT team like coming up the skyscrapers, and I just felt this immediate dread. I was like, oh my God. I was like, the SWAT team are coming for us. And I just started panicking. I'm not even listening to anything she's trying to say to me. I'm just staring out this window like, oh my God, the SWAT team is, I'm climbing the building to come and get us. Like, oh my God. And then I finally just had a moment of realization where I was like, hold on, Paris. Like, you're not some big fucking honcho that people are looking for right now. Like, they don't even know you exist. Like, relax. You need to fucking sleep. Like, this is just, you're starting to lose it now. So yeah, I definitely had a lot of those moments where all of a sudden my reality was really distorted and I couldn't tell what was real or not. Like sometimes I would have whole conversations with people that weren't even there. And it was just so alarming because I'd always manage to wake up halfway through it or just become self-aware halfway through it. And I'll be like, oh, fuck, like I'm talking to myself. I need to go to bed.
Yeah. And so never admitted to a psych unit or anything like that.
I did get admitted in 2019 in Melbourne, but it was mainly because I had a suicide attempt. So that was how I got in there. It wasn't because of drug psychosis though.
Okay. I'm sorry to hear that.
I would venture to guess that the suicide attempt had something to do with where you were in life. And
oh yeah. Everything. Yeah. I was just at an absolute point of desperation. I just felt so lost. I didn't really know how to make things better. Like I'd spent my whole life just running around in chaos and feeling so empty. I had no sense of identity. I just really, I've been diagnosed later with borderline personality disorder. So I had a lot of big emotions, a lot of feelings, and it was really, really hard to navigate through that all. And yeah, I just got to a really desperate point. I was exhausted. I was so tired. I was like, I'm so sick of, living like this. And I just don't know how to get out of this. Like everything seems so bleak. I didn't see the light at the end of the tunnel anymore.
So at what point do you decide it's time to get out of this, and what worked? What helped you get out of it?
Well, there was a few incidents where I had attempted to get better, and unfortunately I had lapses, but I did start that process of like, right, I need to do something about this. I can't keep going this way. When I got admitted into the psych ward, because I genuinely just didn't know how to go on like that. I really didn't. And I had my partner at the time, he left me, and he was someone I really, really loved. And, I broke that man. I absolutely broke that man from what I was putting him through, and seeing the damage that I had done to him. Like I literally saw him become disheveled, like in front of my eyes. Like he had a full physical reaction as well as a mental to everything that I was going through. And even my best friend of 15 years, she had to axe me because she could not deal with what I was going through. I was traumatizing her constantly because I was living with her and she was like literally in the midst of it. And so, I lost those two people that I really cared so deeply for. And it wasn't until, I was a little bit in a woe is me state for a little bit. And then I got back to Perth during COVID in 2020 and I spent 14 days in isolation, which was actually my detox. And I did a lot of reflection. I was like, yeah, nah, like no more of this, no more. I really need to just get on the right track. And, you know, maybe I actually need to get some help with this. Like I'd only ever spoken to a psychologist, but I'd never been to a drug counselor. I'd never been to any support groups, never been to AA or NA. And so I was like, maybe I need to try that. Maybe this is what I need to do now. So it was just, yeah, from 2020, that was when I really started acknowledging the issue and trying to do something about it. Even though there were setbacks, I still kept that mentality.
But so in 2020, so you had to do a COVID isolation?
Yes.
Is that what your 14 days?
Yeah. So when we come back into WA, it was quite strict in Western Australia. So if you'd ever come from another state, you had to isolate for 14 days before you could enter back into WA.
And what gave you the motivation to do that? Because I can imagine somebody in active addiction being like, fuck that. Like, I'm going to go get drugs. I'm not following these rules. So what got you through 14 days complying with this isolation?
I think I was just so desperate. I was just so broken from everything that had happened in Melbourne. And I honestly considered this a fresh start. So I was taking it really seriously. I'd even set myself daily routines in quarantine, you know, where I was like, I'm going to get up and drink a glass of water. I'm going to have a shower and, you know, get dressed. I'm going to have breakfast. I'm going to call a loved one. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And yeah, it purely was fueled out of desperation. I just really didn't want to be in this place anymore.
Hmm. Do you know, Chuck, that reminds me, I feel like, and maybe it's come up before, I'm sure it has, but the other person who used the word desperation was Sonia. Because I remember one of the conversations. So Sonia, I don't know if you know who Sonia is, Paris, but she's in recovery and she lives in Florida. And she's awesome. But I remember one of the conversations we had was around, like, as a family member, I think family members are always torn between what's loving, what's enabling.
Yes.
You know, what do we do? What don't we do? And one of the things that I had asked Sonia, who had also used that word desperation, is that, you know, for example, like having a brother who's struggled with addiction for many, many, many years, there was always that question of, you know, do we pay for a hotel room? Do we, because part of it is the hope that the person gets to a point of desperation that will prompt them or precipitate them reaching out to get help with their addiction. Yeah. And, you know, like my dad, for example, has often used the phrase that I'm not going to pay for a bed for you to kill yourself in. But it's, you know, and I still having lived as a sibling for 25 years, working as a psychiatrist, doing this podcast, speaking to so many people on the podcast, so many patients, I can still tell you that I still don't know the answer to that question. Is, you know, because, yeah, like with my brother, I would absolutely want him to get to a point of desperation. And I would be happy to contribute to him getting to a point of desperation. But so it's just interesting because I remember that word coming up with Sonia. So I'm curious, like, what are your thoughts on that? Because I think most of our listeners are family members. And
yeah, for sure. Like, and I mean, it's really, really tough. It's so, so hard because you do get caught up in it and you do get really torn on what it is to do. Like, what is the right way? What is the wrong way? I mean, I don't think there is really a right or wrong answer here. Like my sister and I, we talked about this a lot in one of my episodes on Shit's Fucked about, you know, she didn't really know what to do. Like she got really caught up in getting into a point of desperation herself because she just saw me turn into someone that she didn't recognize. And she was so desperate to get me back that she was constantly at me all the goddamn time, and it absolutely irritated the hell out of me. Like it did not do itself. I was like, stop like pointing at things that I don't want to look at. All right. Like just fuck off. Like I don't, this is my shame bubble. Like you're not allowed in it. Like, you know, no girls allowed, no boys allowed. And I was just honestly, we were having this really honest conversation about how tough that was for her. And she was like, you know, did that help at all? And I was like, fuck no, like it did not help in the slightest. But it wasn't until I got to the point where I had acknowledged, what was going on for me and that I needed to do something about it, that I was then willing to open up to my family and friends about it. I think if you tried to talk to me before I got to that point of acceptance, it just wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And what was she doing? Like, you know, she was bugging you, but what was bugging you?
She was just constantly asking a lot of questions because, you know, I think she was onto me escorting. So she'd already come across some ads. Her friends had sent some ads to her and she was like questioning me about it. And I just lied through my teeth. I was constantly like, oh, those are photos from my Snapchat. Someone's obviously just screenshotted those and made an ad. How weird. Oh, report it. I would even get her to report my own ad. Just so I could avoid like having this conversation with her. And she was just constantly asking like why I was doing certain things, because I was doing such strange things. Like I was just doing really bizarre things. I was jumping from different jobs. You know, I was suddenly working in an office and then next minute I'm bricklaying. Like I was doing stuff that didn't make sense. So she was just constantly questioning, what the hell is going on? Like your sense of reality is completely different to mine. She was like, I could just see that there was all this stuff going on and you were just not acknowledging any of it. It was like you had this distorted reality, this story that you kept projecting, and it wasn't real. She was like, I was just, yeah, really confused.
So did your sister know that you were in active addiction?
I think she knew, yes, because there was a few.
But because she kind of, like for example, in my case, like, my brother wasn't being secretive. Like, we knew he was using drugs. We knew it was not like a, I mean, do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
It was very out in the open. He wasn't for a long time ready to get help, but we knew what was going on. So, like, did they know or did they just suspect?
They suspected. So there was a lot of talk between, you know, we had mutual friends and people would come to her being like, hey, Capri, like, you know, this is what's going on with Paris. Like, I thought you should know. And she would confront me about it. And I'd be like, oh, my God, I would never. Like, who would? Oh. I can't believe they said that. And I would be so deflective. And so, yeah, she constantly, it's like she knew deep down what was going on. She was seeing it happening. But, yeah, couldn't say for sure. I wasn't out in the open with it.
Gotcha. That's an amazing secret to keep for that long.
Well, living in another state helps.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And an amazing then, secret to think.
Yeah, true. Yeah. It wasn't a well-kept secret, to be honest. Like when my sister and I were talking about it, it was like, she said that, you know, I would often be like, you know, there's nothing going on. Like, you know, it's all gravy over here. And she's like, it would literally be all high beams on you of this just absolute fucking chaos. And you just thought like no one could see you, but we could all see your shit. Like we could all see it.
And so you were telling us like before we started recording that you have done an episode on your podcast with your sister talking about how it impacted her. Was everything that she shared kind of stuff that you already knew, or was there anything that came up that surprised you?
There was definitely some things that came up that surprised me because, you know, the beauty of drug addiction as well is that, you know, you can experience memory loss. And so there were some things that she brought up where I genuinely didn't have any recollection of. So there was a few instances where she was telling me that I'd iced her out for months. I didn't realize I'd actually not spoken to her for that long because I was in my little speedy world. Like, you know, everything, time was flying for me. I didn't realize, you know, how long it had actually been since I'd spoken to her. And she was like, yeah, sometimes it would be like a good 3 to 6 months that you would respond to me. And I was like, damn, like I didn't realize it was that long. Like I thought it was like a couple of weeks max, but yeah, okay. Fuck.
And like when you would go that long, were you in contact with any family? Like were people reporting you missing or?
No. I mean, I would have been posting on social media, like a random photo here and there. I would have been active in other ways that people knew that I was alive. But no, I wasn't speaking with anyone though.
Wow. And Chuck, you've kind of talked about that too. Like you've said, you know, that when you're active in it, time, like you just don't have a real conception of time.
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, and you're right, months go by, years in my case, right, went by, where, and it's not that I didn't realize that there wasn't months or years happening. It's that I don't even want to say that you don't care, because you do, like you really do when you stop and think about it, in my case anyway, like in those, moments of lucidity, if you will. But your brain's too busy doing something else, right? Which is, at the end of the day, what we're fucking trying to do anyway, right? It's just get your brain to do something else. So it doesn't even. And then of course there's the whole snake eating its tail thing, right? Well, now I don't want to think about how long it's been and how, I'm out of touch and how nobody gives a shit, so I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And it just, and where does one start and the other begin? Who knows? And that's the really fucked up part of it all, right? Which is why, and Lisa, you know this very well, but that you are love message that I push so hard all the time, right? Pair something I say often, the perceived lack of me believing that I wasn't loved, believing that I wasn't lovable. And even though, like, especially with the benefit of hindsight, of course I was. But wow, right? You can tell yourself some things and you can believe
Oh,
all the shit,
definitely.
right?
Yeah, and I can relate to that, man. Like, I honestly, I felt so alone in my journey. I wasn't really recognizing that, yeah, there was people around me that really loved me and actually cared about what I was going through, and particularly when certain people had to cut me out of their lives, that just really amplified those feelings of abandonment and like I'm
Yeah. Oh,
alone.
now I have a
Oh,
resentment, and ooh, watch me go with the
no.
resentment, right?
Yes,
Yeah,
I did have a
that's
little bit of
fuck.
that too.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Shit, I had something and it disappeared. Okay, let's circle back to
Were the
it.
you talked about the boyfriend and the friend that had kind of cut you off, were they also active in addiction?
No, they were living very normal lives compared to me. So this was very abnormal, like for them, and was very, very difficult to navigate through. Like my boyfriend at the time, he really struggled to understand because he just did not have those kinds of issues, and he hadn't experienced even a loved one having those kinds of issues. So this was a whole new realm for him. And look, it was too much for him. He really didn't have a lot of understanding, and he didn't know how to navigate through that. He really needed more support than what he had at the time. But yeah, my best friend, she definitely had family that had been through a lot of problems with addiction. So I think there was also a level of resentment that she had towards me because I was bringing up those feelings too. But yeah, it was just, yeah, it
And did
wasn't
your
something that she
boyfriend
dealt with.
know? Did he know that you were using?
I confessed the odd time or two, but I wasn't always honest. And I even was escorting when I was with him, and he didn't know about that until he found my ad, because he had suspicions because I was just, again, up at stupid hours of the night, and just doing odd things. And so yeah, he started looking around the internet to see if that's what I was doing, and he found me, and I lost his trust pretty quickly. Even though I denied it flat out, I still didn't even admit to it. It was my source of income, so I was like, there's no way I'm going to say I'm doing this, because then it's going to be gone. It was just, yeah, tough for him. Very, very tough for him.
And I would say, I don't know if you would agree, Chuck, but I feel like maybe of most of the guests that we've had on, I feel like Paris maybe did a like her addiction was secret from a lot more people in her life than a
But
lot of other
most,
guests we've had.
it's really hard to maintain, right? It's really hard to maintain. That's it. It's almost, I'll say impressive only because it stands out so much, not because I think people should do that, but it is somewhat, it speaks to how, when you take somebody who's intelligent and industrious, which you obviously are, and you throw in a drug addiction, right? Shit gets like, it's pretty crazy what you're capable of, right? For me, I'm an entrepreneur and not dumb anyway. So when I got into drugs, it was drug dealing. You know what I mean? Right. And so for you, and that's why I was able to keep afloat for many, many years before things got really, really bad. For yourself, you found escorting. It keeps you afloat for a long time as, And obviously being industrious and intelligent the way that you are. So it's different. The things that you can get away with, right? Continue doing it, like ruining my health, ruining my relationships, ruining my life, but never any without that big obvious fire for everyone to worry about putting out, right?
Yeah,
Right?
absolutely. And I just found it easier to isolate myself from everyone else because, to be honest, I was experiencing a lot of shame. Like, and I was ex like, I'd have these moments of, yeah, this is pretty fucked up. Like, something really hectic would happen. I'd be like, oh my God, like, what is going on in my life? Like, what am I doing? But like, that would last like 5, 10 minutes. And I would go straight back onto it because I'm like, I don't want to think about this further. Let's
Yes, I have a coping
just get rid
mechanism
of
built in
this.
for that. Oh yeah, I know all about that, right? And I guess, and the thing I was going to say was now, right? You talk about how your sister nagging at you or asking you the questions. So just before I leave for Thailand, I went back to Regina, which is the city where all the bad things happened. And this is what I'm involved, Lisa. I went to go see some people, and I ended up in back around people, places, and things that I probably shouldn't have been at that point. You know, I just cracked a year in my sobriety. But there's some people I wanted to connect with before I left the country for potentially ever. And just it was circumstance. I wasn't doing any. I was around people I shouldn't be around, but I managed to stay the course throughout the entire thing. But I was off grid for what, a day and a half? How many times did you call me, Lisa? Right.
40.
Yeah, in
A
that time,
lot.
right. My mom had messaged every way she knows how to message me in that time, right? In a day and a half. And I come out of that. And like I'm like, oh fuck, everybody just calmed down. But whereas before that would have led to resentment, now, and tell me if you can relate, it's like, thank you. Thank you for giving a shit, right?
Yeah.
I will never ever take that for granted that people care. I'll
Absolutely.
never take it for granted again, right?
Yeah, I
Not with
can
that,
definitely
you
relate to
know.
that for sure. And I think that's the other thing. Like, for so long, I viewed my sister as this really fucking annoying older sister who was just trying to be my mom. Like, just fuck off with your shit.
Lisa,
But
for 36 hours.
boy, but
Yeah.
after coming out of that and looking back over all these years at how hard my sister really tried to be there for me, man, she was always in my corner. She didn't give up on me. Like, she didn't. She could have easily fucked me right off, like, especially after I seen her for a couple of months, you know? But she didn't. She always had hope that, you know, I was gonna come back to her in a sense. And, you know, for someone who I viewed as my enemy for a long time is now my best friend because I've really recognized, you know, she was absolutely in my corner, and how grateful I am to have someone who's that dedicated and values me and loves me so much. They're willing to put up with my shit for that long. Like, so grateful, so grateful.
I'm somebody else's sister.
I know. Well, you know, she was saying that she had never really talked about her story, but that they, you know, she's done a podcast that was more focused on her and her sister's relationship. And I was like, well, it's, you know, I'm a sister, you know? And so I can probably relate, you know, certainly similarities, other differences. Like I said, like it was not a secret what my brother was doing. But, you know, I've said before that I remember very early in his addiction, his first time in rehab, which was 20 something years ago. I think it was like in 2002 or 2003. I remember them doing like a family session, and his caseworker was kind of leading it and wanted each of us to kind of talk about how it had been for us. And I think kind of like an impact statement of sorts, right? And you know, and I don't know that he ever, I think he may have said something to the effect, and not again like in an accusatory way, but something to the effect of like, you have no idea how hard this is. And you know, to sort of walk in the shoes of somebody struggling with addiction. And I remember saying to him again, not in a mean way, but like, you have no idea what it's like to be a sister. You know, to, and again, like I'm the older sister as well, right? So it's like, this is the little brother I used to dress up in my doll's clothes, you know?
Yeah,
I
of
sometimes joke
course.
maybe it was all my fault. Maybe that was the problem, was dressing him in doll's clothes when he was 3 years old. But you know, because you, and it's probably similar to a parent or a spouse or whatever, or even a child, but it's like you feel so helpless.
You
You know,
do.
like this person that you love is suffering and you see the suffering and there's nothing you can do, you know. And I say there's nothing you can do. You can love them, you know, you can remind them that they're loved, you can offer help when they want it. And so you can do something, but that doesn't feel like enough, you know, to just be sending those messages of love, you know. From my side of it, because I feel like Chuck would say it is enough and you don't know how much that means, but on the family member side of it, like you want to do so much more than that. And so it's really
Absolutely.
difficult to be in those shoes and to feel like that's all I can do, you know?
And I actually had a very rude awakening to that exact feeling because I had another family member go through drug addiction after I started coming out of it. And that really, really woke me up to how I must have impacted others. Like, you know, my sister and I, we talked about it previously, but I didn't fully understand the impact until I experienced it myself with this other family member. And it was horrendous. It brought me to a point where I really started to have big breakdowns over it because I was like, oh my gosh, I'm feeling so tormented at the moment. Like, I feel so helpless. Like, this person is stressing me out. Like, I have had sleepless nights because of this person, and I just want to grab them and shake them and wake them up from this nightmare. Like, oh my God. And then it just like clicked. I was like, oh my God. I was like, this is exactly what I've been putting everyone else through. Like, oh, I just put two and two together. And after that, it just really changed my perspective on everything. I even apologized to my ex-best friend, like of 15 years. I was like, I am so sorry for what I put you through. I was like, because now that I'm experiencing it, I really understand what you must have been going through. I mean, like you were on the ground, like you were in the trenches with me. And yeah, I can only
Was the
imagine.
most validating experience ever for her. I really do.
It was very, very healing for her. Like we've really, really reconnected.
That's
And
awesome.
we've,
That's
yeah, we've
awesome.
healed a
I didn't want
lot.
to ask just 'cause, but yeah, I'm really glad that you said that.
Yeah,
Okay.
we have, yeah.
Paris, I want to move on to what you're doing these days. So, and one of the reasons that I like your platform is most of the recovery podcasts or platforms out there are very similar. We interview everybody with who's got a story, do the thing. I pride the Ashes to Awesome on being a little bit different. But you kind of have a different thing going on as well. And I don't even know if you realize it or if you did it with intent.
I mean, do
But
tell.
tell us about yourself. Well, what I've noticed about it is I mean, it's similar, right? That you've got, when you tell recovery stories of all the things that we kind of have to do, but you seem to be working harder at putting people together with resources, right? That's because you've mentioned it multiple times in our conversations off, not recording. You mentioned it in the Black Ash Radio appearance that you did yesterday with us. So tell us about Shit's Fucked. What's A, the name? Let's talk about that, and then maybe, right? It's like I can say it over and over again, Shit Fucked, and like nobody can get mad at me because I'm just saying the name of a podcast or whatever, right?
It's true.
But no, seriously. Why don't you tell us about what's going on?
I'd love to chat about that. So I actually, you know, I'd mentioned previously it was about a year ago that I realized alcohol was a serious problem for me. So I actually decided to go to an AA meeting and I went abstinent for 3 months. And holy fuck, the amount of shit that you can get done when you're not drinking. I had so much time back. I was the most productive I have ever been in my fucking life. And I was just like, whoa. I was like, this was alcohol this whole time? Oh, Jesus. Okay, I should have done this earlier. But this was literally the moment that the podcast was born because it'd been an idea for so long. I had talked about it even when I was in active addiction. I was very much like, I want to help other people. Like, I really struggled to figure out where to start. Like, who do I go to? You know, what resources are out there? Like, what are the first steps? Like, I don't even know where to begin. And, you know, I just was constantly thinking about, you know, there's so many, you know, along my journey, I got to know a lot more resources and programs and support groups that I wouldn't have known existed until I obviously walked that path. But I was like, there's so many people out here that probably don't know about these resources and these programs and that they are available to them. And, you know, even particularly hybrid support groups that are in person and online that anyone from across the world can join in on. It's not just, you know, excluded to, you know, people in WA or in Australia. You know, there's a lot of these resources can go worldwide. And so basically I was, you know, I was in my absence, I was trying to think of a name for the podcast. I shit you not, it was the first thing that came to my head. I did no mind mapping, nothing. It was not like, should it be this, should it be that? No, I was like, man, shit's fucked. I was like, shit's fucked. Done. I was like, sounds good.
I'm just showing off, right? I had opinion polls going on and oh yeah, it was a big to-do, right? Yeah.
Just, honestly, it just came to me straight away and I was like, yep, that's it. Perfect. Done. Lock it in. And so I just started working away on it. And I was like, you know, what do I want this to look like? And, you know, it is exactly what Chuck said. I do really, my intent with interviewing a lot of my guest speakers is to provide further resources and tools for people who are either in active addiction or, you know, their loved ones who might be going through it. But you know what? I've even had a lot of people contact me and reach out to me who have found so much value in the episodes who aren't even in addiction. You know, it's a lot of self-development and personal growth as well. And certain tools that we can use to, you know, grow ourselves further and become more self-aware. And yeah, it's just really blossomed. It's turned into something that, I don't know, it's going even further now. Like I'm studying a Cert 4 in alcohol and other drugs at the moment so I can become a qualified online recovery coach, because I had so many people as well reaching out to me who were just not able to get assistance here in Australia. Like the wait times to get any kind of help is fucked. Like it is insane. And we are losing so many people in these gaps. Like I wanted to be a bit of a bridge. Like if someone's waiting to get professional services, that they can still come on the podcast, they can have a listen to these, you know, these guest speakers and maybe be able to link directly with them or attend another support group or, you know, use a resource or a tool that a guest speaker has provided if I haven't provided one, and like myself. And yeah, just really trying to be that bridge. And I want to eventually launch my own company and kind of have the podcast running linear to it. Like I've had, yeah, so many people reaching out who just can't access these resources, even from, you know, South Africa and other countries around the world. So I was like, man, I really want to be able to help more, but I need to get some qualifications behind me. Like I don't want to just be helping people based on my lived experience. I need to be able to come from all angles. So yeah, that's what I'm doing with the podcast at the moment. And I'm really, really just trying to connect everyone together. Like there's some people that I've had on who provide free counseling services. So I know when I build my company in a couple of months, because it'll launch this year, when I build my company in a couple of months and launch, that if there's someone who comes to me who has addiction problems, but say they're dealing with some kind of trauma or something else that is going on underneath, I'm not just like, you know, sorry, I'm not qualified to deal with that. Like, see you later. Like I can still take them and pass them on to someone else and work directly alongside someone else too with their recovery.
That right there. And I've spoken quite a bit about this recovery community and online at that. Once you start developing networks with people in the way that you quite obviously have and are focusing on doing, it becomes, I've had people from Ireland, South Africa, all over the United States, all over Canada. I don't think any Australians have reached out my way. No, I have. I've had a couple of long conversations with a couple of Australians as well about different things and you know where to send them. It becomes, like, I know, I don't care where you are in the world. If you need help, somebody in our network of content creators and podcasts and all that stuff has a resource in your backyard.
Yes.
Right? And so it becomes this really cool fucking thing that we can do, right?
Yeah.
People can talk about how social media is not real and all this, all they want, but there's some really cool things that happen as a result of the interwebs.
Absolutely. Yeah, right? No, and I think it's so important that we're all coming together as this collective, because it takes, you know, it takes a village, as they say, to help one another. And, you know, we're humans, we thrive on connection. So I feel like having that community as a part of, you know, a way to recover is so vital in someone's recovery. You know, it's
100%.
Yeah,
it is.
Absolutely.
Lisa, I do, we need to move on to gratitudes. We've almost killed an hour here, but before I do that, do you have any other questions? Anything you want to say?
I think what you're doing sounds incredible. And I think quite similar, Chuck, to what you're doing, to be honest, you know, because we do have people on who tell their stories, but we also have a lot of people who come on who talk about their recovery journeys and, you know, people who have that lived experience who are now like both of you guys trying to give back, right? And we've seen firsthand on this show, like we've had people who have come to us who we've been able to connect to supports. And, you know, I agree that I think for a lot of people, one of the biggest barriers is just not knowing. They don't know where to go. They don't know who to call. They don't know what services are available. And particularly when you're in active addiction, you're in this survival mode. You know, it's like there's no pause button where you can go and research resources to go find help, right? So I think that the more people who are doing this, there are so many people suffering with addiction around the world.
Yeah, big time.
So many people that I think the more podcasts, the more that podcasts work together and spread the word, the greater the chance that somebody is going to be like, hey, like I saw this thing and maybe check that out, you know, because it's a huge barrier in mental health too. You know, like I always say, like I feel like if someone comes to the hospital, I'm like, I can help you. But there are so many people who don't even feel that they're worthy of coming to the hospital. Or people with addiction or mental health, sometimes they don't think the hospital is where they belong. You know, they think, well, I'm not having a heart attack. Why would I go to the emergency department? And they don't even realize there's incredible psychiatric supports available, addiction supports available in emergency departments. Like, come to the hospital. Like, you know, I think it's again that thing where sometimes people believe that mental health is not an ailment, you know, that it's not worthy of presenting, that they're not worthy of asking for help. So I think when it comes to mental health and addiction, which to me are one and the same,
they are hand in hand.
Right. It's like spread the word. You know, I often say, like, I feel like we need to be standing on the hilltop screaming that we're here. There is help, you know. And so, yeah, just awesome that you're doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That said, that does bring us to my favorite part of the show. And that's the daily gratitudes. So what you got for us today, Paris?
I'm very grateful for my partner that I have today. Now he's my absolute soulmate and he's my biggest hype girl. Honestly, listens to every single episode the second it comes out, buys all my merch. Like, he is just he is incredible, and I am just so grateful for him. Like, he just, yeah, biggest hype girl ever. He's always in my corner and I just feel so
does
loved.
He like, share and comment?
He does. He does.
Souls. If he ever gets tired of your shit, send him my way. I will. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm so grateful for him.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Lisa, what you got for some gratitude?
But I am healthy. And I'm not really. I'm sick. But, you know, one of the things that I think about often, like, you know, if I get sick and I have a moment where I'm like, oh, this sucks, and I'm feeling sorry for myself, when, you know, we're in Canada and it's minus 20 degrees outside and I'm like, oh, this sucks. And then I realize that I'm sitting inside by a fireplace. You know, I'm always aware, like, I maybe just, you know, having a brother, maybe the work that I do, but it's never lost on me that, you know, my cold's nothing. You know, like, there are people out there who are really, truly suffering. And if all they had to worry about was a cold, life would be a breeze, you know? Or when I'm sitting by my fireplace complaining that I have to go get in the car to go buy groceries, there are people out there who can't afford groceries. There are people out there who are freezing cold outside. Having the cold is just making me, is a reminder for me that I'm incredibly lucky that that's, you know, the biggest problem I've had this week.
I mean, it's obviously not medical.
That's a different thing, right? Well, that's a different beast.
That's a whole new level. Right? Absolutely. Damn. Anyway, for myself, I'm grateful for another great conversation. It never gets old on me, right? It just doesn't. Recovery community in general and how big and awesome and crazy it is, you know, as we continue to go, we continue to grow. I mean, we've got some, I'm grateful for another great conversation, but we'll leave that one at that. I'm also grateful for every single person who continues to like, comment, share, buy goodies, hit the buttons down at the bottom, do all the things, you know what to do.
Love it.
Every time you do any one of these things, you're getting us a little bit closer to living my best life. My best life is to make a humble living, spreading the message. The message is this. If you're an active addiction right now, today could be that day. Today could be the day that you start a lifelong journey. Reach out to a friend, reach out to a family member, call into detox, go to a meeting, pray, go to church. I don't care. Do whatever it is you got to do to get that journey started, because it is so much better than the alternative. If you have a loved one who's suffering an addiction right now, just take the time to listen to our conversation. You just take one more minute out of your day and text that person. Let them know they are loved. Use the words.
You are loved.
A little glimmer of hope just might be the thing that brings him back.